Chris Herring of ESPN joins me to discuss singing happy birthday to the Mavericks rookie center, the reshaped MVP race, repairing John Starks' legacy, and the sheer ridiculousness that is Victor Wembanyama. All that and much more coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. King Saul fell on his sword when it all went wrong, and Joseph's brothers sold him down the river for a song. Sonny Liston rubbed some Tiger Balm into his glove. Some things you do for money, and some you do for love, love, love. John Gennaro, count me in!
1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Today's first words belong to the Mountain Goats from the song Love, Love, Love off the 2005 record The Sunset Tree, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, a partner's powers of persuasion. Thanks to snow here in New York, public schools have pivoted to remote learning for the day, which means that my kids, who are normally not here, are super here, right out there. And that means that my partner, my wife, who decided that she was going to be here today too, is going to do, quote, some magic to get us through the next hour unscathed. I don't think either of us had the foresight to put that in our vows, but I am glad that we came to that point today. And number three, as important as all that, although maybe not as important as nobody coming through that door, I get to spend part of my morning with one of my favorite people in this thing of ours, which I now realize sounds like a mob thing, and it's not. My guest today is a phenomenal writer whose work I first encountered more than a decade ago when he joined the Knicks beat right around the same time as Jason Kidd, Pablo Prigioni, and all too briefly, Cool Mike Woodson. In the years since, he has established himself as one of the most creative thinkers in all of basketball coverage, routinely finding fresh and off-the-beaten-path angles that produce excellent stories like why NBA players lie about their height, why Kevin Durant's shoes keep falling off, and the NBA just can't stop hitting Yusuf Nurkic in the face. He is a veteran of the Wall Street Journal, 538, and Sports Illustrated. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks, and he is now a senior writer at ESPN, and for some reason has made time to slum it with me today. Friends, a warm welcome for Chris Herring. Chris, thank you so much for making the time for us today. How are you doing?
Well, first off, bless you, man, for such a kind intro. This has already been a lot of fun, just in chopping it up with you before this and you know, the first minute or so of this.
I love that it makes it sound like you're out. You're like, this has been great, man. I am out, though. I gotta bail.
it's honestly been fun already. And I'm doing really well. Same thing as you. Snow day in New York. A little less hectic probably than having full family here, but just my fiance teaching her sixth grade students downstairs while I'm here upstairs. So doing well and happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy that you have an upstairs. That's levels, and I appreciate it. That's literal levels, but it's also figurative levels. I respect it and I appreciate it. Chris, I've asked you here today not only because we are stuck inside on a snow day with remote school happening, but also because we're kind of an odd point in the NBA calendar. Like, you know, we're coming down off the high of the trade deadline. There's like the senioritis vibe of the last few days before All-Star. Yeah. I didn't want to ask you to break down like the skills challenge. So I figured we could do like a little bit of reflection. And since this is the week of Valentine's Day, Wednesday, Valentine's Day, if you are listening to this and you don't know that, get thee to a store. I thought it might be fun to frame this in the context of love, like our friends, the Mountain Goats up top. Some things we've loved watching this season, some things we think we're going to love watching. Generally, stuff we like is a very basic framing device, but I thought it might be fun. And we will get into that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So as an on-ramp to this discussion, Chris Herring, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
I have to be honest. The thing that it was actually from last night. I am a clear sucker, and I don't know why I'm like this, but I am a clear sucker for those. Like, everybody remembers Giannis's, like, God bless America tweet about the smoothie, where yes. He spelled it smoothie, where he just had one O in it several years ago. And also the idea of him, like, you know, getting a driver's license here and needing to learn how to drive and kind of like those moments. So I'm always a sucker for those sorts of things for whatever reason. last night, the Mavs game, Derek Lively hasn't been able to play because of the broken nose that he has. So he was in street clothes and he joined the Mavs broadcast team for a few minutes during the game since he was in street clothes. And it was his 20th birthday yesterday, and the whole arena sang happy birthday to him on the Jumbotron, you know, while he's sitting there with the big ass nose bandage that he had. And during the interview that they did with him during the broadcast, they were talking about the fact that he still lives with his mother at his mom's house. And he was just talking about how much he loves home cooked meals and laundry and kind of like, why would he ever leave sort of thing. And it's crazy. And you and I probably have both had this experience of just like, we're not young anymore from the, you and I aren't young anymore from the standpoint of like relative to the people that we write about. I can
hear Jake Fisher in my ears talking about how extremely not young I am. Like, he's not on this episode of this show. Jake might never make it onto Dino Dungeon. Don't tell Jake that. But I can hear him just like roasting me about how extraordinarily not young I am. But I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
No, but I mean, the truth is anybody that's covered the league at this point for, I mean, with the exception of maybe Shams, like everybody who's covered the league for the amount of time that we have is going to be in their at least mid-30s. Right. And, you know, Nikias is another one who's covered the league for a little bit now. I mean, he's in his late 20s, but that, you know, we're older than most of the people in the NBA. And so it's crazy to look at guys that are that young who, you know, despite all the money they make and kind of how widely known they are people that still live at home. But complete shout out to him for his birthday. And it really did make me smile to kind of watch that. And to watch a whole arena kind of sing happy birthday. Like, I, you know, I'm just now getting used to seeing the Knicks have these walk-off interviews where, you know, guys are being chanted MVP for. That's unusual for their fan base, but it's also unusual to watch a whole arena sing happy birthday to a rookie. It was very, very cool, actually.
That's really, really cool. And also, like, who among us can't relate to the feeling of like, well, it would be pretty rad if you had home cooked meals constantly and someone doing laundry for you. Like,
yes.
That's, I mean, you know, part of adulthood is realizing that part that goes away a little bit. And so
very much so.
We can appreciate that. And also, yeah, like, if you are of the mind or the kind of person who does not recoil instantly at the idea of like 18,000 people doing something directed at you, I imagine right. It would feel really nice to have all of them singing to you and wishing well.
Yes.
That's it. That's wonderful. And yeah, shouts out to Derek Lively. Although, again, you are literally less than half my age, which
I know.
I'm going to go just shrink into a corn cob and shrivel up over here. But maybe we'll get through a podcast before I do that. Well, that's a wonderful transition into it's the general framing device, as I mentioned earlier, sort of like NBA love letters, some stuff that we have loved watching to this point in the season through the first, and not really the first half because we're, you know, past the 40 game point when we get to the All-Star break. But these first few months of the season, things that we've enjoyed can be big picture, small picture, team, player, whatever. So in the interest, I will be a generous host. Would you like to go first or would you prefer for me to go first?
Why don't you go first? This is your show, and I've got plenty of stuff to pull from. I'm sure you do as well.
All right. Well, okay. We'll start with the obvious caveat that I don't love Joel Embiid being injured, right? Let's start there. I don't love him now officially falling short of the 65-game threshold for being considered for major award, a major award accolades at the end of the season. I do love that the shape of the MVP conversation feels like it's going to be a little different. That there's just some new arrivals, some returning champions, sort of a bunch of different folks. I saw that just before we got on, our friend Tim Bontemps, your coworker at ESPN, put out the new edition of his straw poll. And with Embiid being out of the mix, you know, Nikola Jokic goes right up to the top of that conversation. But it's not, and obviously richly deserved and has been sensational for a team that is vying for the number one seed in the West, but that you also have, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, like, you know, going up and, you know, clashing with the Titans, right? Like, you know, a guard going up and being in the mix with those, you know, those giants that we've seen dominate the league over the past few years. You have, I think it's like 31, 5.5, and 6.5 on 54% shooting for a two guard while leading the league in steals. Like, it's just ridiculous numbers, ridiculous production, and ridiculous impact on winning. And then, you know, you go through it. You know, there's the familiar faces like Luka Doncic, maybe going to lead the league in scoring now with Joel Embiid out of the way and almost putting up 10 assists tonight as well. Like, Giannis is shooting 65% on twos and putting up 31, 11, and six. Here's a nerdy little stat that I loved about Giannis. He has, it's not a shocker that he would have the most made field goals inside of 5 feet. Like, he constantly shoots from there and he makes a lot of those shots. He has made 494 shots within 5 feet of the rim. Second place is Zion Williamson with 320.
Wow.
The gap between Giannis and Zion, one and two, is the gap between Zion and Bam Adebayo in 54th.
Wow.
So, as many
contextualizing it that way is insane.
Yeah, as many things as have gone, you know, been like, you know, weird and janky for the Bucks, like that part, Giannis go boom still works really, really well, and there's the Kawhi Leonard getting back into the conversation and Jalen Brunson getting the MVP chance, as you mentioned, Donovan Mitchell like putting himself into that kind of like maybe bottom of the ballot category, like there's. It feels like we've got some fresh blood in that conversation. And while the way we get there is a bummer, I like that there's sort of some new stuff to appreciate if you're along the way. It doesn't have to just be either this guy or that guy or you're an idiot. It can be like a reason to actually kind of celebrate the different ways in which these guys are getting their teams where they need to be.
Love that. And I agree with you. Again, nobody wants to see anybody hurt. There might even be some people that are kind of frustrated now and seeing how exactly the rules are applied or work. I would probably feel a little bit differently, by the way, or more strongly about that if we were talking about a situation where Embiid, you know, hurt his finger or something and missed, you know, was able to play 64 games. This is something that fundamentally might have kept him out of this race anyway, just on top of the other games he'd missed. So it's, to me, let's see who else ends up being disqualified by the rule. But it is exciting to at least have new blood, fresh blood in the race. I had Shea, you know, in my top five last year, I'm pretty sure. But the context around that and the way people will think about it and consider him for this award is totally different when you're talking about OKC being potentially a top three seed. So it's amazing to see him in this race. All right, so that was your love letter. I've got a list of things here. You mentioned Brunson. I've been going to a lot of Knick games lately, having moved back to New York and having worked on a feature about the Knicks relatively recently about Anunoby.
I was going to say a great feature on OG Anunoby that's, again, in the way that I talk about Chris being very, you know, fresh angles and different ideas. Everyone sort of presupposes that's going to be a story about how OG Anunoby transforms the Knicks defense. And what this actually shows you is he has transformed their offense as well. So if you have not read that at ESPN, please go seek it out. It's fantastic work. Sorry, go ahead.
Thanks so much, man. No, I appreciate it. So in writing that or preparing to write that, working on that, obviously spending more time around the team than normal, I have been kind of blown away by really just how many guys the Knicks have that are stepping up into new roles. And so obviously been well chronicled now that Randall is out for considerable time. Mitchell Robinson's been out for probably a month and a half, 2 months at this point or whatever it's been. OG now has missed time and has since had surgery. Brunson's missed a couple games here and there. But in all of that happening, normally where you would consider that like, okay, a team is going to lose because of this, the Knicks up until very, very recently, like last week or so, had still been winning. They'd had the longest win streak in the league. I think they are tied for the longest win streak of the season at 9 games. You know, Deuce McBride, Precious Achiuwa, Dante DiVincenzo, Isaiah Hartenstein. We're talking about guys that have played big roles, some more than others, especially Hartenstein and Dante DiVincenzo. But lately, Precious Achiuwa, like, these are guys that a lot of people would have had questions like, are they good NBA players? Or at least in Precious's case, I think that's fair to say. But Hartenstein was viewed as a good backup. And this is someone that since he joined the starting lineup has been one of the better centers in the league from the standpoint of he's a great rebounder, great offensive rebounder. But he's someone that it's to a point now where I think on some level, if he and Mitchell Robinson were both healthy, I think you could at least ask the question of, like, is he a better fit with the starting group than Mitch, despite Mitch being the best offensive rebounder in the league? He just does some different stuff. I don't think you miss so much from a rebounding perspective. And by the way, it's really difficult to go from being a backup five, who, generally speaking, you can probably foul as much as you need to or want to.
Right.
He struggled with that the first couple games of being a starter, where he had not really been in this role before, and just kind of adjusted, self-adjusted, and, you know, all of a sudden goes from playing the minutes he's playing to playing 35, 36. You know what it is to play for Thibodeau, playing 43 minutes or whatever you have to, right. Which, you know, after last night with DiVincenzo getting hurt, playing, what was it, 41 out of 43 minutes, it becomes a concern at times. But not just him, but prior to his injury, Dante DiVincenzo becoming arguably the best kind of role-playing three-point gunner in the league, having multiple games in a row of shooting 15 or more threes in a game, second in the league in threes. I mean, it's wild to just watch these guys kind of adjust to these roles and fill these gaps for a team that has had a lot of injuries, but record-wise doesn't look like it. So, you know, I would kind of say it's like the Knicks having shark's teeth on some level of maybe the guys replacing the stars are not stars, but they've done it meaningfully and impactfully. And, you know, it's part of why the Knicks are even in a conversation for a two, a three seed, what have you.
Absolutely. Precious Achiu is a fantastic call out because I knew that he had shown, you know, really impressive flashes on both ends of the court while he was in Toronto. Like, there were periods where you look at the switchability and the way he could guard up or down, and you thought, like, well, that could be a high impact defender. He'd been, you know, a pump and go drive guy and like attacking the offensive glass. He'd shown some touch and some ability on offense. But I would look at that and think, like, this is just the kind of guy that Tom Thibodeau might like completely mothball because he makes one. He blows one assignment and Tom Thibodeau is like, absolutely not. And it has gone so far the other way. Like, Tom Thibodeau is like completely, like, some of that is necessity, but also, like, I think he has like 3 16 rebound games in the last 2 weeks. Like, he's been super good defending the rim. He's been switchable on defense. He's been attacking the glass. He's like in those like double playing power forward or five. Like, he's just shown so much versatility, and where, like, that was a guy that I think was widely seen as something of an addendum to the Anunoby trade. Like, oh, he just sort of makes the math work and wound up being like a super important player there. I feel like I've probably said too many things about the Knicks, which is probably why the basketball gods are punishing the Knicks with more injuries and more difficult things happening for them, because I've been too effusive and too positive. I've allowed briefly.
All of us, really.
Yeah, but Chris, what you have to understand is I'm the one who deserves bad things happening to him. So when I start to be happy, that's when the cosmic balance has to be struck. But I will say one of my little love things was I love that everybody in every arena in the NBA knows that if Josh Hart gets a defensive rebound, he is taking it straight to the rim. He is driving end to end and barreling through two or three guys to get there. No matter what, he's doing it, and he's going to do it every time. And then when he gets there and he shoulder blocks somebody and doesn't get a call, he's going to be like absolutely apoplectic that he didn't get the call and wonder what happened. And everyone knows what's going to happen. It's a transaction we're all familiar with. And yet it still seems like sort of wonderful and surprising anew every time. Either he's going to make the layup and you're going to be like, how the hell did he do that? Or it's going to be like, how the hell did he think he was going to get that call? Everyone knew for 45 feet he was going to drive into the chest of two dudes. And he will, but it's like a new surprise and a new fresh surprise every time. So Knicks basketball surprises spring eternal. Although over the last like week or two, maybe some fewer surprises, maybe just some the pleasant variety we can get. Some guys actually coming back healthy into the lineup. Hope springs eternal there. Next one up for me. I love that our early season success stories aren't going away. I love that Minnesota is still at the top of the West, right? Like, and not only at the top of the West, they just smacked around the Bucks and the Clippers on the road by 20 plus. And they'll go through periods where they look up and down and the offense can get, you know, shaky and station to station. And when they don't have Mike Conley on the floor, it can get disorganized and you're relying a lot on Anthony Edwards, you know, reading the game out, or if Karl Towns is going to be able to make passes through tight windows and all that kind of stuff. But that defense travels, the energy and the effort travels, And when they lock in, they can shut off even elite teams' water like they showed against the Clippers. And yeah. So like they're not going anywhere. Maybe, you know, we'll see how they are in a playoff series, but it wasn't like, oh, that's a nice story for 6 weeks and then it's over, you know? And there's a bunch of them like that, you know. The Orlando Magic are still, there's, I think they're 7-4 since they got Franz Wagner back in the lineup, 5 games over .500, 6th in the East, like better than a coin flip to make the top 6, depending on your projection systems. And Indiana weathered the Halliburton absence, and they're right there in that mix too, right there with Philly and Orlando and Miami, still right up there at the top of the East, or the top of the East in offensive efficiency. The Thunder, you know, duh, we just talked about SGA, but that whole roster, like, youth is being served there, and you know, they're right in the mix for the top of the West. So like, even the one that was sort of an early rabbit that has fallen back to the pack was the Rockets. And even within that, like, yeah, they've been bad since Christmas basically, but they're still a top 5 defense. Like a lot of what we saw early in the season in terms of, oh, that's something worth paying attention to, has remained worth paying attention to. And as you get into the dog days of the season, that stuff can be kind of tricky to come by. So I kind of like that it wasn't just like the league has resolved to its sort of familiar formula by the time we get to the midpoint. There's still some stuff that kind of caught us by surprise that's continuing to happen.
Yeah, no, that's a great call out. Maybe my favorite one since we started the love letter segment, in part because I think you're spot on that I know I've been, if you want to call it, guilty of this before as a writer, and specifically a writer that likes to highlight funny, unusual, this doesn't happen that often type stories, or things like you mentioned the Nurkic story I had where he was getting hit in the face all the time. Stories that do happen all the time but are weird, or things that happen all the time that are weird. For instance, I really, really, really wanted to write about the Kings and how great a season they were having last year, because it was kind of like a comet situation, like this doesn't happen. And I tend to want to do those early in a season before they're not actually the case anymore. And so absolutely, like, to see the Timberwolves there, to see Oklahoma City there, as granted, like, there's nothing fluky about what they're doing, but age-wise, this doesn't happen much where you have teams yes. that perform this well. And, you know, you mentioned the Magic, you mentioned the Rockets and their defense. All those things are spot on. And the staying power of that, specifically in a league where there are so many threes being taken and there's so much variance within the game, it would feel really possible for teams to kind of be hot and then just super, super cold and fall out of the race. So to see that actually hasn't been the case, and that it's actually been a handful of teams that have won championships, the Lakers, the Warriors, that are kind of struggling and fighting and clawing their way back into a conversation of playoffs, play in, whatever you want to call it, is really, really interesting to watch. And so I think that's a really, really good call. For me, I want to, one of the things that makes me really happy to see, if it's a love letter, I guess we can call it that, but happy to see, I am such a big fan of players that are known more for their defense than their offense. I have a soft spot. I will admit all day long that I have a soft spot. So Andre Robertson was someone that I really, you know, like, the guy couldn't play a lick of offense if he made a three. Like, it wasn't, I grew up in Chicago. It wasn't quite Dennis Rodman level as far as, like, when he made a three, the way the crowd went nuts. But it's Andre Robertson making his free throws was kind of an event a lot of the time. So, you know, let alone like making an outside shot. So from that standpoint, I've always had a big soft spot for players like that. And granted, this was too early in Herb Jones's career to ever be concerned on that level. He was a 33-34% shooter from three, which is like almost average. You know, if you gave him a couple extra percentage points on the good end of that, he would be an average 3-point shooter. But he's over 40% this year, and is shooting more of them. And that's the sort of thing where it's like, he's already a great defender, a great defender, a guy that is blocking 20 shots a year from 3-point range, which is like hard to do.
Ridiculous.
Because generally speaking, guys are open when they take those shots, especially the guys that he's rotating to. You know, only a few guys can do that. Mitchell Robinson is another one that I think about, who just has the arm length and, you know, but he's someone that we've always thought about him on that side first. He's talented offensively, he's got skill offensively, but the shooting was one of those things where, like, if that never comes around, he's still going to be good enough to be out there just because of his defense. If the shooting comes around, though, which it's looking like it has, it fundamentally changes the scope and the dimensions of that Pelicans offense, just because that's someone that you can't help off of the same way. And if you can't help off of him the same way, what does that mean for trying to defend Zion, for Brandon Ingram, for McCollum, for trying to rebound against someone like Valanciunas? You just can't keep bodies inside the paint the same way. And so it's a huge difference for them if he can continue to keep that up. But even if he can't, the fact that he's done it for this long, if he finishes the season somewhere around 36-37%, you're not, you know, that's nothing to just sneeze at that point. It would be a big improvement for him, particularly on the volume of what he's taking, which is, I think, 3.5-4 a game, something like that.
And it's a great, I love the that you entered into this from Andre Robertson, because that was a thing that the Pelicans have had to do the last like couple of postseasons, or, you know, when they get into the play-in or that kind of thing. It's like, well, if teams are going to shrink the floor, all right, well, I guess we use Herb at the five, kind of. Like, we make him a screen and dive guy, and he can make plays on the short roll. He can do some of that in space. But if he's able to be someone you got to close out on the perimeter, it completely changes the geometry and the geography of the floor, as you mentioned. And another guy in that vein, shout out to Chris Dunn. You know, like, yes. up over 40% from three. The volume's not the same, but 40% from three in Utah. And that's like, that's a lifeline for a career. Dante Exum in Dallas. Yeah. Like, you get those guys up over, like, you can make those shots, then the defense gets to play and you can be on the court in games that matter. And you can suddenly, you go from, you know, high end lottery pick that we can't quite build around to, you get to be on the floor for teams that, mm-hmm. you know, Utah obviously is maybe making an active choice to go the other direction, but like, you get to be on the floor in games that matter for pretty good teams. And that yeah. is it's not a transition that everybody can make. Like, I think understandably, we view shooting as a skill that's like among the easier ones to develop as a pro. Like, if you get to the league, you can build the shot. And that's true, except when it's not. And we've seen a lot of guys where it isn't true, you know? And so when it does work out, and then it sort of opens up a guy's career, that's a thing of beauty. And yeah, Herb Jones, I'm Lucy with the football, or Charlie Brown with the football with the Pelicans. Like, I keep wanting to believe, you know, you mentioned, you know, writing those stories early in the year. Like, last December, yeah. I was like, oh man, they're coming. And then, yeah, you know,
I did one. Yeah, I was guilty.
Dude, we've all been there. Yeah. But so I keep doing it. This year, I was like, man, after the in-season tournament, you know, they've been one of the hottest teams in the league. And then for 2 weeks. And it's, you know, so maybe it's me, maybe it's just the way, you know, the rhythms of these things. But, you know, I can see, I'm keeping hope alive for the Pelicans. And Herb Jones is one big reason why. Speaking of hope staying alive, though, man, like, I like that the Bucks are trending in the right direction.
Yeah, defensively.
You know, they're coming off of a big statement win over the Nuggets on Monday night, where Giannis was just like rampaging. I think it was like 36 and 18 in 30 minutes. And you're like, well, what the hell are you supposed to do with that? But this is a process versus results kind of dichotomy. And so you look at it and say, they're 3-5 since Doc got there. They haven't been lighting the world on fire. But the whole thing is, can you pluck the low-hanging fruit defensively? Can you get them into just a more stable environment? Even if you don't have great elite defensive personnel at the point of attack, we all know you move from Drew Holiday to Damian Lillard, you move off of Grayson Allen, you move off of Javon Carter, you know, like the talent changes. And so you expect some slippage on the defensive end. But can you just like not give up the store on that end? And under Doc, they've gone from giving up the most transition opportunities in the league to tied for second fewest per game. They've gone from, you know, bottom 10 defense to just outside the top 10 in defensive efficiency, defensive rebounding rate, turnover percentage. Like, they're doing the things that you need to do, the right kind of shot profile, which they were doing under Adrian Griffin too, to some extent. But like, I think sixth or seventh in shot attempts at the rim. They're right around the top 10 in limiting 3-point shots. So like, the stuff that we know the Bucks to do, plus don't beat yourself on defense and transition. Turns out that when you do that, and then you have Giannis and Dame, you put yourself in pretty good position. So yeah, 3-5 doesn't look like any great shakes, but I think what you saw against the Nuggets is like, this is what the fully realized version of this can look like. You can even go up against an elite opponent and smack them around because you've got that high wattage offensive talent as well. And if you just sort of stabilize and systematize the defense a little bit, it gives you the opportunity to elevate. And then, you know, they have not lost touch. I mean, there's a big gap between Boston and everybody else, right? But they are, I think, a game back of Cleveland now for second. They're right there. You know, the Knicks continue, as we mentioned, their injury slide. So like the Bucks are still very much in that 2-3 mix. You know, if Boston picks up a knock and they go on a run, it could absolutely be, you know, within hailing distance of one as we get down the stretch here. So there was so much said and so much, you know, ink spilled and so many, you know, minutes on podcasts like this talked about, you know, why you would move on from Adrian Griffin, what the idea would be, how is Doc Rivers even all that good, yada, yada, yada. And maybe not. We'll find out. The playoffs are going to be the truth serum for all of that. But in terms of just stabilizing and moving things in a direction where you can feel more confident about who the Bucks could be, I think we're starting to see that. And I think in terms of the hopes for the most competitive version of that top of the East, which could be an absolute bear of a first couple of rounds, I think that's a pretty positive thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the decision to move on from him, it's not to say that the front office is completely immune to criticism or bulletproof from that standpoint. But I feel like that's one of those things where if stuff is that bad or is that problematic, again, with regards to their process, you would get the impression that people in the building would know that more so than we would. So you can't judge it solely off wins and losses. I'll say this. I'll put it this way. There were some people, and I don't think it was a majority, but it was a very vocal minority of like, the Celtics need to move on from Mazzulla after the way the Celtics looked last postseason. Okay, if you're going to think that off of 1 year and one season where they were within a game of making it to the finals, granted they were down 3-0 and then they came back and made it a series, but if that's going to be your takeaway from a season where you watched the whole season play out and were frustrated about how it looked, the front office simply was saying it looked okay from a wins losses perspective, but the process wasn't right. It's hard to see how one group of people could argue that after a season, after how watching it, how it plays out, and the front office, where they're more in tune with how stuff is actually coming along, what the players are saying, knowing about the rumblings that are taking place, or maybe direct complaints that are happening, like they fundamentally tried to take hold of something before it unraveled in a portion of the year where we would see it in the postseason. So I understood it, even if I didn't know all the ins and outs of it. Like, you're only doing that if you see something glaringly wrong, or see the potential for something glaringly wrong, because this is a team that's trying to maximize its window. And I think other teams kind of soft pedal it with that. You can't, it was a big decision to hire a first time head coach anyway. So if you see things that procedurally are not what you want, I understand it from that standpoint. I actually think that to some extent, if they were able to keep up this defensive improvement, that would be a pretty clear sign of the fact of like, even if this doesn't work, it was probably the right thought, unless you felt like right. You were seeing turnarounds during Griffin's time as coach. This is the first time in more than 2.5 years that they've held two opponents in a row under 100 points. And the transition part of it is massive. November 2021, maybe not more than 2.5 years, but about 2.5 years. So that's a pretty considerable sort of thing when you talk about that. That was something that was breaking their defense. And Doc has always been, I'm thinking back to a story that I wrote a couple years ago about the value of rebounding, or the lack of value in rebounding relative to what it used to be. Or big time rebounders like Andre Drummond and stuff like that. And Doc was talking about I can remember in Doc's voice specifically the way he was talking about rebounding and transition defense and the value of going for offensive rebounds versus just being back defensively so you can't get beat in transition. But anyway, neither here nor there. I think that was a really good call. The one other thing I would say here, just to not get too far away from it, because it was incredible to watch the highlights of. I did not watch it live, but then I was disappointed that I didn't watch it live. It sounded the way that a crowd sounds when they're watching a Magic show. Wembanyama yesterday in Toronto.
Thank you, Chris. Yes. Please keep going.
I mean, 27, 14, 10, which normally when you talk in sequences like that, you're talking about assists. He had 10 blocks. So he had a triple-double through blocks. He also had 5 assists. This man did not even play 20. He didn't even technically play 29 full minutes, but he played less than 30 minutes on the road as a rookie. And the crowd was just spellbound. I mean, at some of the passes that he made yesterday, like, I actually had to watch the clip 3 and 4 times to try to even see how he did it, because I felt like there was a glitch in the way that the camera shot it. It was, I mean, like, which I'm used to seeing that with Luka. I've seen that with LeBron. There have been times where Jokic has done it too. Obviously, he's the best passer in the world. I didn't realize that Wimby had all that in his bag from a passing standpoint. I've been watching him a lot.
The dimensions are different. It shouldn't be happening with all of that, all of the arms everywhere like that. It's like Dr. Octopus throwing no looks.
And it just, like, poor Jakob Poeltl, like, just trying to get a shot off and looking like Jalen Brunson trying to pivot and pivot and pivot to just get a shot off. And it seemed like it basically never happened. You know, poor Scottie Barnes, who thinks he's all alone until Wembanyama's just there and just kind of morphs into the same space that he's in. But just a masterful performance, a dominant performance. You know, the first sequence of the game was one where he blocked a shot at the rim and then came down and hit a three, you know, all within the same 15 seconds. And it was like, okay, it's going to be one of those nights. It's kind of the way it looked. So just incredible and continuing to do stuff that we rarely see. I think that I saw a stat, if I'm remembering correctly, the only rookies to have ever done this with points, rebounds, blocks, triple-double, all made the Hall of Fame. And so it's like, bodes very, very well from that standpoint. It just makes me pray even more that he's healthy throughout his career to be leading the lead in blocks. And granted, we all know how tall he is. And you know, a lot of people be like, well, why is that surprising? Because, again, health is always going to be a concern, a question for people his size. But, I mean, this could be someone that if he's healthy for his whole career could lead the league in blocks every single season that he plays. And as we saw yesterday, can stuff the stat sheet in every single category, not just blocks, not just points. But I think he shot something like 39 or almost 40% from three his last 13 games. Like, he's here, and he has been all year. But, like, the consistency that he's playing with in certain ways is just scary. And like, how dare the Spurs get another guy that you can just build around for the next 2 decades? It's scary stuff.
That was why we had Shea Serrano from shouts out to Shea from the wonderful show Six Trophies with our friend Jason Concepcion. Had him on No Cap Room before the start of the season. And my first question to him was just, how dare you, like, that you get another one of these guys? This is preposterous and unfair. It's something that I had on my list too. Like, that Pop eventually just said, like, it and made him, and it's like, we're putting him at center. Like, we're just gonna, like,
yep.
We started with the training wheels, we started with Zach Collins, and let's just put him there. And then since December 8th, so that's when Collins went to the bench, December 8th, Wembanyama is averaging 21.4 points, 10.3 rebounds, 3.6 assists, and 3.6 blocks in 27 minutes a game. 49, wow. 36, 81 shooting splits, and the Spurs have a top 5 defense with Wembanyama on the floor in that span. So, like, a team that has been one of the worst in the NBA from, you know, sort of tip to tail this season, defends like a top 5 defense with him at the center spot in this, like, whatever, 25, 30 games that we're talking about here. He might already be, like, defensive player of the year, final top 5 on your top 3 on your ballot, kind of, like,
sure.
You could certainly make the argument for it, not just the blocks, but also all the shots that he alters. It was very funny. Devin Vassell, after the Raptors game, said, like, I guess it's not on the scouting report that Vic blocks shots, which...
He had 6 in the third quarter. 6 block shots in one quarter. Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah. So, like, it's like all of the things, you know, there was this is the year of experimentation, and we're going to see if Jeremy Sochan can be a point guard, and we're going to see if Victor Wembanyama plays power forward, or if he's a big wing or whatever. It turns out the best answer here is put him at the 5 and let God sort him out. And we've been seeing an awful lot of that recently.
Yeah.
Sticking with, like, young guys that are fun to watch cook. Like, I love watching the Thompson twins play. I know they're not like, so my compass might be all sort of out of whack here. They feel like the most free Darko guys to come into the league in quite a while. Like, shouts out to my old heads here, but where it's like, this is a style clash for me, or style component to me. Like, It's like if you put Gerald Wallace and Josh Smith on like 2x speed and listen to them fast is the way that I feel like watching those guys. Like they defend everybody. They're like spiders with, you know, arms and legs everywhere. They do not back down from any challenge. They sprint the floor constantly. They're looking for cuts off the ball. They're smart about the way they move. They look to pass. They pound the glass. Like they just do everything cool except for shooting. And the numbers on the shot, and you know, like I say this not to come in, you know, in unfair critique of them, but they've played together about, or in total about 1900 minutes, Amen and Asar Thompson, and they've combined to make 18 3-pointers. And so it's not what you want in terms of the outside shot or the free throw shooting, but maybe the shot can come around. We've talked about that a lot. You know, I just mentioned that as something, a skill that can be developed. That everything else is there in this package. And it's what it's as advertised by all the, you know, the draft Knicks, the people who are watching Overtime Elite, and they said, like, watch them on the prep circuit and everything. So like these guys are going to come in with like NBA bodies to do everything and do it 100 miles an hour, that it's there. And that there's like craft and nuance and touch. Like Amen and Alperen Şengün already have some kind of like high-low chemistry, and they're like, they look for one another and they find one another in the, you know, along the baseline or under the, like, on the cuts. There's just something so much, they are refreshing to watch in that way, because like everyone knows the path for that kind of guy is take 6,000 corner threes,
yes,
get pretty good at it. And it's like we talked about with Herb Jones or with, you know, Chris Dunn or with Dante Exumor, insert wing guy there. Mm-hmm. And they're not there yet, but they are so compulsively watchable even without it. And I think that they could not build that part of their game and still maybe have like 10-year careers. But I think that you're seeing how like the feel and the work ethic and just like the motor that they've got everywhere else makes me feel really bullish that whatever the high end, you know, option or potential for those guys is, that they're going to reach it, because man, they are fun to watch.
Yeah. Like as you were talking, I just think about the guys that you have those hopes for. And it sounded like even the guys we were talking about, a lot of them tend to be guards. Like you mentioned Chris Dunn earlier, of like career altering stuff. Exum, the same thing. It's really hard to play as a guard if you can't develop a shot at some point.
Right.
Even if you are really, really good kind of in the nooks and the crannies, if you can't shoot, it's hard to make hay with that. If you're bigger, sometimes you can get away with a little bit more. Bigger guys have not always been expected to be able to shoot. But the guys that I think about, and like Justice Winslow is a guy I think about too. Like I think I just saw that did he just get a G League deal, or did the idea that he's about to be called up from the G League?
I think he's with Raptors 905. I think.
Yeah.
Maybe wrong about that.
So I'm really hopeful always for guys that like never quite develop the shot fully, but you can look at guys right away and tell whether they make sense out there because they can do everything else. And these guys are rookies, and they cause problems for other teams, like with their defense. They're really, really solid as passers. They cut at the right times. They can rebound. And it is incredible to watch the feel that they have, even without having a shot. And so I'm really hopeful for each of them. But I feel like you said, they're going to be around. Like, I feel like especially watching the Pistons this year has been obviously really, really interesting. But in light of a lot of things,
that's one word
around,
for it. Interesting's one word for the experience of watching these Detroit Pistons.
Yeah, just very interesting. And I mean, it's interesting too, because I was thinking this and having this conversation the other night when I was at the Knicks game, of just watching Alec Burks and watching Boyan join the Knicks. And it's like, you know, and then hearing Thibodeau talk about like, look, I know guys are new. It's just an effort thing, though. Like, if your effort is there, everything else falls into place. And I couldn't help but think, like, yeah, the coming from the Pistons and then playing for the Tom Thibodeau Knicks is probably a big difference in terms of, like, what the expectations are and, like, the way that one coach might respond to something versus another. Not to say that Monty Williams is soft from that standpoint, but, like,
right,
Thibodeau's going to have higher expectations than anybody and everybody. And so, but anyway, I say that to say that those twins are going to be in the league for, I hope, for a really long time. Like, it's really hard to get the nuances of some of the stuff they understand at any point in an NBA career, let alone as rookies. My fear, like I said, is the Winslow types that you can tell that they fit and just they don't have enough of a shot. Frank Ntilikina is one that I believed in until the wheels fell off from that standpoint. I'm
Chris,
I know.
Why are you bringing up old stuff? Chris, damn, man. Like
I know. But he meant like a guy that efficiency-wise led the league in pick and roll defense and guarding pick and rolls as a rookie. Like that doesn't happen. And so you find yourself when you find those things that you really are looking for any and every opportunity to try to make something work. And again, these guys, you're not going to have that issue just because I feel like they're bigger. They can start a fast break. Like there's a lot that they can do outside of shooting. And you do trust that the shooting is going to come around with hours and hours and hours in the lab.
Speaking of the hours in the lab, Chris, you have one more that you want to do before we head out to make some money on a break?
You know what? We actually talked about a lot of what it was. I mean, I had a couple other things listed. You talked about the Wolves a little bit just in the season-long stories. Like, I just wanted to make light of the fact they've won a team that has lost the most games or had the worst record over the last 19 years, 20 years in the NBA, has won more games by 20 points this year than any team in the league.
That's a fantastic stat.
You know, like, I love that for them. Watching them just legitimately bludgeon a great Clippers team, which by the way, I'm looking at my email from last night. The ESPN Stats and Information Group plugged a stat that I think the Clippers have only lost 7 games since the beginning of December. And of those 7, yes. It looks like of those 7 games they've lost to, there were 6 teams, but they lost to because they lost to Minnesota twice. So of those 6 teams, 5 of them ranked in the top 7 in defensive efficiency. So it tells you how great the Clippers have been. Basically, like if you don't have a great defense, you're not beating them. But the Timberwolves have done it twice now. And as we talk about the Timberwolves and all the things that are good about them, this is a team that can defend. And this was the whole reason that you made that Rudy Gobert trade that, you know, as recently as this summer, early this season, we were all saying like, ha-ha, you know, they gave up all these things, all the Walker Kessler, you know, critiques and kind of like, how could you sort of, I will say this about myself. I remember a couple years ago saying, like, I think it was maybe 4 years ago saying that I thought Jokic would finish his MVP. And I was 1 year early with that. It was wrong. I was 1 year early with that. And I remember saying last year that I thought Chris Finch would be coach of the year. And, you know, all these things would happen. I was wrong with that. It was off by, I mean, who knows? Maybe he doesn't get it this year. But I just kept thinking to myself, like, Tim Connelly is smart. Chris Finch, I imagine on some level, had to be aware of the fact that this trade was going to be made for Gobert. And based on that, they probably had a meeting in the minds. And they said, here's how we're going to make this work. And that these guys are too smart for them to not have a very clear plan in place for how they want this to look. And last year, Cat gets hurt and it doesn't work. Or it doesn't work to the extent that, you know, all those picks that you gave up and everything else, it didn't work. And a lot of people were critical of it and wondering, should they get off Rudy Gobert this quickly? This is what it looks like when it works. And I mean, team being the best defense in the league and just basically a team that clubs refuse to shoot the ball around the rim against them. And if they do, it kind of turns out the same way that it often turns out when you try Wembanyama at the rim. You know, so you get that plus the offense that they've gotten from Anthony Edwards, and, you know, and just the wisdom of Mike Conley. And you got another guy in your lineup that can go off for 62 on a given night, you know, obviously just one time. But this is a legit team. You got McDaniels defensively. You haven't even gotten great, great play out of slow-mo, obviously. But it's just a team that I'm so excited to see what happens. And you talked about teams not falling off. It's been wonderful to not see them fall off, for them to just legitimately look the part and go in and beat the crap out of the Clippers, who absolutely are a contender to win the whole thing and probably one of the favorites to do it. So, you know, I don't want to gloss over that too much. And it even just lumped them in with the teams that haven't fallen off. I mean, they've not only not fallen off, they look the part and look like they could cause some real damage, you know, in the playoffs.
Absolutely. And I love to put a button on it. Just let the self-help component of this show, keep this in mind. Maybe you're not wrong. Maybe you're just early, right? Maybe you were just a year early on whatever the thing is that looks like it's not panning out for you. give yourself some space, give yourself some patience, give yourself a pat on the back. That's right. Like Chris Herring. We are going to take a quick break to go pay some bills, and we'll be right back with some more Chris Herring on Divine Intervention. Now that we've sent our love letters, Chris Herring, we're going to wrap up with something that we call the closing five. You, as someone who is a certified ball knower, are aware that how you finish is more important than how you start. And we do five questions with our illustrious guest. Question the first. You're an alum of the University of Michigan, the reigning NCAA Division I football champions. What were you feeling as you watched that team get to the top of the mountain?
I was feeling like I was happy that the money I spent to go to the national title game was not spent on a loss, or that the Rose Bowl game that I went to was not spent on a loss. I was happy that I decided to shell out the money to go do those and go to those games.
Experiences like that don't come around all that often.
Yeah, I was a student there from 05 to 09, and you know, they were such a perennial Rose Bowl, you know, Big Ten contender, title contender every year. I guess that's what perennial means. That I didn't make a point to go to the Rose Bowl when I was in college the one time they went, but I figured they'd be going another time while I was there. I think I had to get my wisdom teeth pulled during the Christmas break. So I told myself, like, next time they go back, I want to go. And so I was in the middle of basically moving during the holidays. You know, so kind of did that in the midst of a move, but I'm happy I did it for the Rose Bowl. And then again, for the title game, it was like a monsoon the day of the title game in Houston. It was crazy, but I'm happy I went. I was thinking that I was happy that they, and I think the NCAA president said it, that they got a chance to kind of prove that they could, you know, that they were outed on the sign scandal thing, which, let's be honest, Michigan alums, Michigan fans, like, they absolutely did it. Like, the Michigan versus everybody thing, sure, on the one hand, but also, like, we kind of made ourselves victims in that. Maybe they came down heavy during the season, and then the, you know, the Big Ten suspension on Harbaugh. But whatever, I'm happy that they punished us midstream so that when they won the title, everybody knew that they were doing that so that they could change their signs. I would much prefer that, and Michigan winning it all anyway, than Michigan win it all, this come out later, and then it kind of invalidate, like,
right,
it would be real Fab Five-ish, except the Fab Five wins the title and then takes the banners down. It's a much different, like, more deflating feeling to have that questioned forever. So I'm happy that they were caught and got a chance to show that they could win regardless. So very, very happy, like, emotional on some level that my dad, my parents met at Michigan as grad students. And
oh, I didn't realize, you know, that.
So I was, you know, walking around as much as I could walk, and, you know, my Michigan stuff as a 2-year-old, and you know, I've got pictures of that. And my dad was the reason I fell in love with Michigan football. You know, my first real memory of college football, which is my favorite sport, by the way, like, I would not even debate whether it's that or NBA. College football is my favorite sport. And my first real memory from college football is my dad just shouting in, like, horror that Cordell Stewart threw the, you know, the miracle at Michigan pass. And I just remember thinking, like, why does my dad care about this so much? And so then it got me into it, you know, through heartbreak, I guess. But, you know, I thinking about the fact that my parents, my dad specifically, just got me into the sport, and that my parents have passed away. So just, you know, thinking that this is the first time since that happened and that they both passed, that they won a title, I was really, really happy, really, really proud, even though, like I said, I know they cheated at some point during the season, whatever, but I'm happy that they won the whole thing. I'm not apologizing for that.
Yeah, we all make our compromises with our fandom. That's part of it. And I think, yeah, that's wonderful. I didn't realize that about your folks. That's really, really cool. And I would imagine that experience a hell of a lot better than getting your wisdom teeth pulled.
A lot better. A lot better.
Question number two, as part of your reporting for, as I mentioned earlier, the fantastic book, the best-selling book, Blood in the Garden, you sat down with Pat Riley. I am wondering, is that as much like getting an audience with Don Corleone as it you imagine it is from the outside?
I so wish it was. I actually didn't sit down with Pat. I really wanted to, really, really wanted to. I went to the guys. I mean, I could walk you through how I tried to get them. I went to Pat's hometown in Schenectady in upstate New York. It was actually very similar to the snow day we're getting, where it snowed several inches the day that I went to, like, go kind of see the high school that he went to and that, you know, they've named the gym after and all his trophies and everything. So I went there, got a tour of that area, went to his childhood home, went to the area where his dad owned a general store, talked to people that grew up with them, spent a couple days there in the snow, did all that, talked to other childhood folks he knew, spent real time with them in Houston and other parts of the country. And then kind of worked up the courage to say, all right, Pat, like I've done all this, had someone give me his cell phone and left a really long text message for him, kind of like Aaliyah, 4-page letter, being told by people, including like Wright Thompson is kind of one of the only people aside from his friend Dan Le Batard to really get Pat to open up. And Wright Thompson was able to do that for a magazine story that he wrote. He's always been great at getting whether it's him, Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan to open up. He was able to get Pat to open up. So I asked him like, what was your in? And so he gave me advice on that. And he told me like, if he can see that you put in the work to really get him and you want to tell more than just a fringe story or, you know, you want to really get beneath the surface, like, I think it might work. So I did all those things kind of almost like Wizard of Oz where they go and, you know, you got to go get the Wicked Witch of the West broom or something to be able to get your trip back to Kansas. I did all that and I don't get a text back from Pat. And I'm thinking it was actually almost 3 years ago to the day or 4 years ago to the day because Pat, it was All-Star weekend. And so I remember thinking like Pat is going to have some downtime granted with the All-Star game and stuff. So I waited for a text back, never got one. I was like, okay, this isn't great. And then I remember Zach Lowe was in the process, I think, of writing a Bam at a bio story. So he was in Miami or with Miami at the time where Pat got the text. And so I later hear from Zach, like, and this was before I was working with you guys or with Zach. Really, but he was like, did you reach out to Riley? I'm like, how the hell do you know that? Like, and he's like, yeah, like I heard you reached out to him. I'm like, how the hell do you know that? And if you've heard that, why have I not heard back from him? So then it turns into this thing like, I think you're going to be hearing back pretty soon based on what I heard. I'm like, and it made me like respect, but also like hate like Zach and Woj. I'm like, how do you guys know stuff before the rest of us know it? But anyway, so it then turns into this thing. I get a message from, I think I reached out to the Heat's PR person, Tim Donovan, and he was like, oh, yeah, yeah, like Pat got your text. He wanted me to respond to you. Like, he really appreciated the effort you put into getting him, but he's not interested in talking. And I remember just feeling like, wow, of being really hopeful and excited and to speak with him. I had so many questions for him. Even after this process was over, I still sent a list of questions to him just to give him one final opportunity to respond. There were, if you would call them accusations, and there were different things in the book that kind of I think were at least appropriate to ask him about big decisions that he made and choices that he made. One huge one involving the NBA Finals and not pulling John Starks. I was in that 2-for-18 game and some reasoning behind that other people kind of laid out potential reasoning. So I wanted to give him an opportunity to respond to that, but I actually didn't speak to him. And I really wish that I had been able to. somebody who's friends with Pat wanted me to sign a copy of the book for him. And I was like, why? Like I can imagine that some of the things in there, he's not going to find to be all that glowing. And they're like what? And then I walked them through it. They're like, you don't understand. You made Pat look like a maniac, but he knows that he's a maniac. He loves this stuff. I was like, oh, okay. But I'm not wired that way. Pat knows who he is and he probably does recognize that. So I still haven't heard from Pat. I hope to talk to him at some point. I really do. But I did not get to talk to him for the book, unfortunately.
All right. Well, I feel badly about that now, and I apologize, but I'm glad that you talked me through everything that you did there. And I also now have to go into a question three. It was going to be later, but now I'm going to go right into it. True or false, John Starks unfairly maligned for his performance in that 1994 finals?
I'll say true. I'll say true. And here's why. A lot of people probably forgot until they read the book, if they read the book. His great uncle passed away right before the NBA Finals started. He had had kind of a whole crew of family. I think it was like 20 family members that were going to be coming down from Tulsa, where John grew up, for game one of the NBA Finals in Houston. And what was kind of expected to be a family reunion actually ended up being like a really, first of all, not everybody could end up making the trip because they, you know, his great uncle died unexpectedly. And so a lot of the family reunion kind of turned out to be more of a, essentially a funeral, for his uncle. And so he's, you know, he was very close to his great uncle. He didn't, he either didn't travel with the team or, you know, he left the team for a day or two when he went down to Houston, before he went down to Houston to go back to Tulsa. And he played awful in game one. I'm trying to remember. I think it was 3-for-17 in game one, if I'm remembering correctly, or maybe 3-for-18. Shot poorly, you know, admitted after the game that he just wasn't mentally there. But then games 2-6, he, in a series where Patrick Ewing wasn't good offensively at all, he just couldn't score on Hakeem Olajuwon. So John Starks kind of, by default, became essentially their number one option in some ways because he was really comfortable and was playing well. Shot, I think, 50% from the field from games 2-6. He shot 45% from the field in games 2-6, from three, I mean. And he was averaging like 5 or 6 assists a game. He was their best answer for Houston's really, really good defense. He had a chance to win. He had double digits scoring in the fourth quarter of games 4, 5, and 6. He had a chance to win game 6 and the series for the Knicks. Again, in a series where Patrick Ewing was not really playing well. I think he set a record for blocks in a series. Defensively, he was blocking a lot of shots, but he wasn't really showing up offensively the way that you would hope. So Starks was doing a lot of it for them. So was Derek Harper. But Starks was their leading scorer and I think probably their leading assist guy as well in that series. And shooting 50, 45, whatever his free throw percentage was, he was doing very well. Game 7 was brutal because after Hakeem Olajuwon blocked the shot at the end of Game 6, a shot that John Starks had made 6 shots in a row leading up to the last shot of the game. So Knicks fans had to feel really good with him getting that look. And it was a good look. Hakeem Olajuwon switches into the play and gets a fingertip on the ball and changes the trajectory of it, comes up short. Starks was essentially traumatized by that play and later explained that he basically had insomnia for 3 or 4 nights, the 3 nights before they played game 7. And so he just was not focused. He was jittery. He was tired probably. And he was in like just try to make it right mode, basically. And so he starts off game 7 slowly. He got in early foul trouble and he's just trying to shoot himself out of the slump. I think he was 1-for-7 in the first half. And then the second half was even worse where he's 1-for-11 in that half. And he's just shooting and shooting and shooting. And to the Knicks' credit, to their coach's credit, like most people had questions of like, why are you not pulling him? And again, to Riley's, what I needed to ask Riley about was essentially Rolando Blackman wondered and players accused Pat Riley of not giving Rolando Blackman a chance because Rolando Blackman had words with Pat Riley after the series before that against the Pacers about wanting to bring their wives on the trip. And so do I deep down think that's why Rolando Blackman didn't get a chance in that game? You know, despite Rolando Blackman having averaged the most points of his career against the Rockets specifically, and the Rockets being terrified of him from all those years he played with Dallas, I don't necessarily think that's the reason. He didn't play in that series at all. So, you know, Riley would have been going deeper into his bench to go to Rolando in the first place. But I think Rolando could have made a difference just by giving John Starks a 2-minute breather instead of just trying to kind of bum rush your way through a slump like that. I think anything could have helped. And obviously, it's easy to say that in hindsight. Starks was the guy that got them there. And so I get it. You know, it's not to knock Riley at all. But I also can't blame Starks. Like, he can't take himself out of a game. The coach has to do that.
Sure.
And that's the way he was wired of. He was very capable of having a 2-point game and then a 37-point game. It's just how he was. He always had confidence in himself that he could get right the ship. And so without him, they don't have a chance to win that series with the way Ewing was playing. So you win and you lose that way. And, you know, if anything, I think Riley should have pulled him at least for a breather. I'm not going to put it on Starks. I think that I don't think fans do either. I think that, you know, Charles Smith is received a certain way within Knicks lore. And it's very different from the way that Starks is. And I think it's because people don't fault him for that fully. And also just that there were a lot of good moments to celebrate with John Starks.
Your answer is correct. John Starks rules. Question number four. During your time at Sports Illustrated, you were one of the hosts of the Open Floor podcast, alongside a pair of former Divine Intervention guests, Michael Pina and Rohan Nadkarni. Which one of them did you find most insufferable to work with?
Oh, man. I'm going to get in trouble. I'm trying to weigh whose fandom of which team was more annoying. You know,
the answer can be yes.
It could be both. that probably is what it is, to be honest with you. I mean, it's like, I think Rohan is less shameless about the way that he pulls for Miami. And Rohan normally is the one that starts the stuff in our group chat, like trying to instigate Mike. So I'll probably say Rohan here, but you know, in all seriousness, it didn't bother me. I thought it was funny. Also, someone that doesn't really feel an allegiance to any NBA team and hasn't for, you know, since my teenage years, probably. It's kind of fun to have people that care that much. Like, I, you know, these guys are wonderful to work with, and I'm legitimately sorry that, you know, just with the craziness of Sports Illustrated the last few years, that we couldn't make it work. You know, just I think we made it work, but just that stuff kind of devolved the way it did. But
sure.
I love those guys both, and was happy to have them as teammates. Really, really happy.
I'm sorry. That's incorrect. The answer is both of them. And question number five. As I mentioned up top, I think you're one of the most, you know, creative thinkers and interesting writers in our little world. The way you approach
stories, I
find super, super refreshing. Divine Intervention is nothing if not an admiration society. So I'm wondering, who are some people that you feel that way about, where you, you know, the way they approach the game, the way they see it, the kinds of questions they ask, et cetera. Who are those folks that you really enjoy the way they pull on those threads?
Well, and I say this, and I think I would say it anyway, if I wasn't on your podcast. I think there's something
you can't
infectious
say me. You
about
can't
the
say me.
Joy.
You can't say me. You can't say me. You
but
can't
there's
say me. You
something
can't say me.
Okay, fine. I won't say you, but there's something about the joy with which you approach the game. I won't say that I appreciate it, but I'll say that it's cool. And I mean that.
I'm furious about it.
There's certain people that you can sense that with. I think you're like that. I think Nekias Duncan is like that. And it's really cool because I think even me, when I get in my ruts, I can be like, man, I can kind of forget that the 14-year-old me dreamed of doing this. And
right.
I was grumbling the other day about, you know, my fiance and I normally take our date nights. It's normally like a Friday night, a Saturday night. And we'd had, you know, we couldn't do it that Friday. And so Saturday would have been our date night. And then I kind of forgot that the Knicks had the game coming up against the Lakers at MSG. And it's like,
right.
Oh, I got to go to the Garden for the game. And then it's like, wait a minute, I'm getting to watch LeBron and you're like 21 play at Madison Square Garden and not having to pay for it. Like, this is incredible. So I really appreciate people that seem to keep that perspective often. And you're absolutely one of them. Again, I think Nekias is another. We were mentioning earlier off air, Rob Mahoney will always be one of my favorites, my absolute favorites. I think the way he approaches the game, like the nuances that he notices, it's funny because it's like you were talking about my work and maybe being off the beaten path or kind of counterintuitive. And Rob, I don't think his stuff is counterintuitive, but just in this day and age of kind of like fly by night and like, you know, a three sentence tweet and that being viewed as a story by a lot of people, or people blogging and aggregating that into a story that's five sentences long. Okay. Our attention span for Twitter and everything like that. Rob dives and dives and dives and dives further and further and further into something that is so interesting when you really, you know, break it down. I don't know if you've ever seen Uncut Gems, where the movie, I think, starts with them going into a gym and just kind of keep burrowing into it and all the different colors that you see. And it's like, that's how I feel about Rob's writing. And even when he was podcasting and when he's done podcasts before, the way he talks about the game feels that way. It's just like, there's so many different permutations of everything that kind of involve the way something unfolds and happens. And I think it's a really beautiful way to view the sport. Candace Buckner, she doesn't even cover the league every day anymore, but I loved the way she approached the game. And love that when she writes about the game, the way she approaches the game from, you know, there's so many things I can think of. But like, I remember she's done stories on haircuts and how and when players decide when to get their haircut and, you know, the barbers in the league and stuff like that. And just a class act, but so much fun to talk to. Caitlin Cooper, who I know has joined you before, is someone that the exes knows. Like, sometimes it's almost too high level for me to really pick up on right away, but she's basically scout level stuff.
Blew my doors off. Like, I asked her, like, basically, like, so how is Halliburton doing this? And she was like, brrr, and I was like, oh my God. Like, absolutely, like, it was like a pelted up against the wall.
Yeah. And she got, I remember, like, within months of him joining the Pacers, which it's so incredible to think about the fact that he just, like, was a Sacramento King and now he's a Pacer, and that he was just, you know, maybe a superstar at this point, if not very close to that. And that I remember, you know, Tyrese Halliburton taking notice of the story that she did on his jump passes and kind of how effective they were and how it's absolutely not what coaches tell you to do at a young age, but that he's perfected it, and that he, you know, still has a 98-1 assist to turnover ratio and all this stuff. And he took notice of it and was talking about how cool that was. And it, I just can't think of anything cooler than someone who specializes in covering a team that doesn't get that much attention and doesn't get that much exposure, and to have a star player notice it upon joining the team, basically, how cool her storytelling is. Don't let anybody tell you that you have to broaden, cover the whole league or focus on every team. I remember asking if Caitlin was willing to do that because we were looking for more people at 538 at one point when I was there. And I was like, I can't think of anybody that writes about the game in a more smart way than she does, where it's interesting. It's, you know, I remember doing that sort of thing at the Wall Street Journal, where before some of these really newfangled statistics existed, I was going and counting things by hand with a stopwatch or with, you know, on my phone right. of how long Melo was holding the ball and jab stepping before he actually dribbled or made a pass. And it's like, you know, the statistics that kind of unfold from that. But, you know, I was being paid, you know, and paid pretty decently to do that by the Wall Street Journal. Like, some of these people are more or less doing this for the love of the game and for the love of, of informing people and for understanding it better themselves. And I always think about Caitlin from that standpoint. So bless her. There's so many people. I could go on for days and days. I think you know that.
But these are wonderful names. Also, Candace got too good at doing this. She had to get leveled up. She had to go like to every sport up. And do it in a columnist level. So she you know, left our punk asses behind. all right. So we'll slide from one level of recommendation into another. The last thing we do on Divine Intervention each week is a weekly recommendation. Can be about anything. Does not have to be about the world of basketball. Recent examples have included like the graphic novel Saga, listening to Andrea 3000's flute record while you do other stuff, cooking dinner for somebody to let them know that you care about them, going to the library, taking a walk. There's a bunch of stuff. So it can be kind of anything, something that is cool and good that you think would help the folks that are listening. So Chris Herring, what is something you would recommend to the listenership?
Okay. I am someone that struggles to write listening to music. I have been for a while. I think even more so when I'm trying to work on a book, write a story, like I kind of need enough of my brain still available. I like to be able to hear the lyrics and really listen when I'm listening. So it's hard for me to multitask with that, except for when I'm listening to Miles Davis. And I would say more recently, and this is the first artist I've been able to listen to lyrically and just kind of enjoying the music more with words, is Alex Isley. She, you know, is related to the Isley brothers, the daughter of one of the Isley brothers, and the niece of Ron Isley. She has an album called Left My Heart in Ladera. And like, I'd heard about her a lot, but I hadn't really listened to her stuff. And it's like, anybody that likes listening to Sade, which is probably someone else that if I tried, I probably could listen to while I was writing, because it's just so smooth and easy to listen to. Alex Isley's album I can listen to while I'm writing, which I love that, because it's like I can kind of relax a little bit more than just sitting in and, you know, with no noise at all. And I think a lot of people like to write and like to do things with music, whether it's running or whatever else. So the album is called Left My Heart in Ladera. I watched a mini series on Hulu recently with my fiance called Black Cake, which I will readily admit is not the easiest watch. Like, it's a little bit heavy, but it's really, really layered and kind of takes me into a different culture, Caribbean culture, that I haven't spent much time around. And it's just a really, really great. I've heard that it derived from a book and that they made it into a mini series. I think each episode is about 50 minutes long. We, and shout out to my fiance for suggesting this. We watched the first episode and we're so spellbound by it that she was like, I don't want to binge this. I want to just watch it a little bit at a time. And
right.
It was fantastic. I think it might legit have a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which like never happens.
Sure.
So it's just that good. And then last one, I posted, I think there was a thing going around earlier in the week, Jared Dubin had posted, and I saw he'd reposted somebody on like the 10 movies that he's seen the most in his life, not ranking them or not saying how good they are, just saying that like, these are the 10 I've watched most. And one I did not put on there, but one that I really love and rewatched because I love so much, is The Conversation with Gene Hackman. That's not the title of it. The title of the movie is called The Conversation,
yes.
But Gene Hackman is the star of it. And it's just, I think that there's probably like of the ones I've seen, maybe 10 to 15 movies that I would say like I wouldn't change anything about. That's one of them. It's, you know, 1973. It's in that era's Francis Ford Coppola movie, you know, and just during that Godfather era. And it's just such a good movie. And, you know, when you think about surveillance systems and everything like that, it's just it's so interesting to watch that movie and the preconceived notions you go on with and the perceptions and then the plot twists. It's such a good movie. I really, really love it. So I've got one book too, but I've also made so many recommendations at this point. So
Chris, this is extraordinary. The level of commitment to the bit that you've put in here. What the hell? Give me the book.
Okay. So the book is called A Death on W Street. It was actually a book that one of my closest friends, his name is Andy Kroll, wrote. I went to college with him and wrote at the school newspaper with him. He writes for ProPublica now as an investigative reporter, but he wrote a book on A Death on W Street is about the murder of Seth Rich, the Hillary Clinton intern who was working for her during the campaign. And, you know, basically his death, his murder was politicized from the standpoint of turning into this massive conspiracy theory of the idea that, well, he had to be taken out because he knew too much about the Clintons' operation that they didn't want out there. And it's like, okay, there's no evidence of that. And so Andy kind of uses, and I didn't even realize this until I read the prologue of the book. Andy knew Seth a little bit. He played like rec soccer with them and everything. So it meant something to him personally to write the book. But just the reporting that goes into it and kind of explaining in painstaking detail how conspiracy theories start, how thinly some of them start and just kind of out of nowhere and off of very little information, no confirmation whatsoever, and how they spread and how they can be so costly from the standpoint of, you know, claiming people's lives and really changing people's lives in a really dangerous way, and how it kind of reverberates throughout society as we talk about democracy in this country. So maybe it would be boring to some people, but I majored in political science. I'm a kind of politics buff, and it was terrifying to read a lot of the stuff in the book, but I was really, really proud of my friend too. So I've read that one now twice. Like I said, I kind of read and rewatch things over again when I really like them. But A Death on W Street was one that I enjoyed and was really freaked out by, just in understanding the genesis of a lot of this stuff more.
I need you guys to understand that Chris Herring wants you to be a smarter and better person overall. He's out here recommending music that can get you through your day. He's out here recommending that you learn about the world around you and how ideas take hold and the dangerous ways in which they can move around in our culture. And he also wants you to watch The Conversation and remember the Gene Hackman rules. Like, there's a lot to like about what Chris Herring is bringing to the table here today, ladies and gentlemen, and I need you to focus on that. I am comparatively much dumber than this. I think you should watch Detroiters. It's a sitcom that ran for 2 years on Comedy Central. You can find it on Paramount Plus. It's Sam Richardson and Tim Robinson, Zach Kanan, the guys that made I Think You Should Leave on Netflix, which I would also very much recommend you watch and enjoy.
Very writing down Detroiters premise. Right now.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a cameo from Jim Harbaugh in there too. You'll enjoy.
Really?
But it's, yeah.
My mom's from Detroit too, so I love this.
So it is the rare kind of show that actually it uses a lot of people who grew up in Detroit and like was made in Detroit and like uses a lot of people in the acting roles and the on camera roles actually being so, as opposed to just like we parachute in someplace and don't actually make a contribution to the culture in that
That's
way.
Important.
It actually because both Sam Richardson and Tim Robinson are from, I believe, outside Detroit, or from, I don't know exactly whereabouts, but it was an important thing to them to like make it actually about the people who live there and, you know, actually populate the area. They play, they're best friends, they're next door neighbors, and they run an advertising agency together where they like do local, like low budget commercials for like local businesses. And they are very silly people. And it is, there's a lot of comedy that goes into that and some wonderful cameos. As I mentioned, Jim Harbaugh's in there, Keegan-Michael Key, Chris Redd, a ton of super talented people that show up in that show. Really, really funny half hour comedy that is about silly nonsense. And, maybe as a palate cleanser from some of the more more daunting stuff that we are consuming on a day-to-day basis, I would recommend giving that one a try. I find if you have come across any of the I Think You Should Leave stuff in the like internet memo sphere or any of that kind of world, and you've dug that, I think you would really dig this as well. So Detroiters, okay, go check that out. Man, Chris, we have covered a lot of ground today. Before we get all the way out of here, also, Blood in the Garden, Blood in the Garden, Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks. Wherever you find fine books, you will find that, and you should do so. Chris Herring did a wonderful job in reporting and writing that book, and it deserves even more attention and praise. Chris Herring, speaking of which, any other things that we can point people toward on the way out the door here?
Thank you so much, man. First of all, for having me again, for plugging the book repeatedly, which you did not have to do. not really. I mean, I'm always doing stories and, you know, kind of looking for the next story. So I've got a few I'm working on. But no, just I feel like part of my time when I get free time, aside from date nights and stuff like that, is just to work on book two, which is kind of kicking my butt. So that's really the big thing. It'll be about another NBA team. So hopefully you can finish it sometime soon, but it's, I don't know. It's worth it in the end, but it's, man, you get some dog days doing it. So I'm just trying my best to grind with that. You mentioned Pat Riley before, so, you know, some ties to that, but, so hopeful. I'm hopeful that I can pull it all together. But
I have no doubt that you will. And I very much look forward to learning more about that. Also, yeah, Chris writes for ESPN. That's a pretty big website. You should go check that out. that is going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. Thank you so much to Chris Herring for taking all this time to be with us and to reconnect with himself. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make the show look and sound great week after week, but not after this week. We will actually not have a new episode of Divine Intervention next week. The All-Star break is also my kids' midwinter break from school, so I will be DNP family. But Vinny Goodwill will be back tomorrow with another episode of The Good Word, and me and Jake Fisher will be back here on Thursday for another episode of No Cap Room. Still plenty of audio coming your way on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed. Where you are getting this, please rate it, review it, give it 5 stars, promote it, tell people that you liked it, tell people that you listened to it, tell an enemy, I don't really care. Help us grow the show, helps with discoverability, all that kind of stuff. I think that's about it. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.